Welcome to Them Before Us on American Family Radio, where we strive to put children before adults. Our goal is to educate the public on a child-centric perspective of marriage and family and represent the rights of children on policy matters. Now, here's the host and founder of Them Before Us, Katie Faust.
Welcome to Them Before Us Radio. I'm your host, Katie Faust, founder and president of the children's rights nonprofit Them Before Us, where we seek to put them, the children, before us, the adults, on all matters of marriage and family and beyond. Well, it feels like the month of February is screaming by. I cannot believe that we are nearly at the end. And there's been a lot that has happened just in the first month and three quarters of 2025. So we're going to spend the first couple segments here doing a recap of the absolute fire hose of children's rights content that has especially been coming out of the White House and state by state around the country. We want you to be informed because children need you to champion their cause for them, especially when it comes to justice in the area of politics. But before we do that, we are going to, as always, begin with a little bit of Bible time. I read the Bible with my two remaining children who are at home with me before they go to school every week. And earlier this week, my 17-year-old decided to start reading Romans because he's going to be studying with a mentor and some friends. And I'll tell you what, every verse or two in Romans chapter 1, we had to stop and discuss. But this specifically stood out to us after describing, you know, why God's wrath is coming. He lays out, like, what you need to know about me is clearly seen through what has been made. There is a level of general revelation where you can understand there is a God, you are not him, and judgment comes if you are not going to abide by his good guidance, his moral law, the conscience, as Paul talks about, that even unbelievers have access to. And then Paul lays out the digression of what happens when you reject this self-evident knowledge of God that has been manifest through creation. So he says, they didn't honor God or give thanks to him, but they became futile in their thinking. Then their foolish hearts were darkened. So it begins with you get stupid. You reject God, stupidity follows. And then their foolish hearts are darkened. Morality declines. Claiming to be wise, they became fools, exchanged the glory of God for the immortal God for images. Then idolatry results. And then he goes on to talk about all kinds of lust, namely homosexuality. So we talked about that, rejecting God for who he is. You become dumb. Then you become immoral. Then you start to worship idols, and the idols typically have some connection to sexual degeneracy. And that's a pretty tried and true pattern. Unfortunately, we've been able to see it in the West as well, a rejection of God, you know, in the name of whatever, postmodernism or the Enlightenment or whatever. We have unfortunately seen the last couple of decades characterized by being stupid. I mean, literally, some people are incapable of rational thought and believe that, for example, men can become women. Morals have gone out the window, whether you're talking about protecting the unborn or protecting the very, very elderly or the disabled. Idols, specifically worshiping self as it relates especially to sex, sexual identity, sexual desires. And then, of course, all different kinds of debauchery from heterosexual premarital sex to disgusting forms of pornography to exaltation of homosexuality, not just as something that is acceptable, but that's a core part of your identity, on to eroding protections around pedophilia and polygamy. You're seeing it all. So this is not something that is new. This is actually utterly predictable. Like, this is the original, hey, God called this, and we just are seeing it over and over.
I had a conversation the other day with someone who was messaging me on Instagram, and they were talking about objecting to something that we had shared. And it struck me, you know, this person was advocating for a much freer sexual ethic than we at Them Before Us believe. You know, we happen to draw our reasoning from the gospel and the way that that's played out in the world through natural law. It's what's best for kids. And as a result, we have what I would consider a really strong sexual ethic, which Romans would affirm. This person, though, however, was saying, you know, you are drawing the line the wrong place. It's actually here. And now they had a line, and that's what struck me. They had a line. They had a Rubicon, if you will, if we're going to talk about Romans, a place to which after that is now wrong. And for them, that could be minor attracted persons. It could be consent laws. Like, they have things. But when I pushed on, well, why is your line there? It's nothing but the human heart that determines that. It's what triggered their ick. It's what triggered their disdain. It was whatever was in their heart. Well, I said, hey, look, I'd almost have more respect for you if you were taking, you said there should be no. You know, then I'd understand. You're being consistent. But for you, you're completely determining this on your own heart and emotions. I draw a line too. I'm just saying my line comes from the gospel. It comes from ancient truth and wisdom. And I'm going to stick to that. And I'm going to draw my lines here. It's interesting here that this oftentimes this darkness or this becoming dumb, becoming ignorant, often comes in the guise of this elevated thinking that I'm going to follow the wisdom of the age and I'm so much more refined than you because I have this different empathetic approach. When I'm perfectly fine with saying, hey, just tell me where your line is and what's making you draw that. Because I know you have one and we all draw them. Ours is just coming from the Bible and we're more clear about where ours comes from.
I think your friend is suffering from, you know, some form of like 1990s syndrome of, oh, the Christians came in and squashed everybody's fun. Oh, you guys, you backwards traditionalists, you know, why can't you be more tolerant and open-minded? Sorry. But especially when it comes to sexual ethics, tolerance and open-mindedness results in child victimization in pretty much 100% of cases, whether you're talking about abortion, whether you're talking about, you know, creating children through IVF, whether you're talking about making motherless and fatherless children through sexual unions that are not taking place within marriage or even elevating marital unions that will always exclude a mother or a father, they are wrong. They're simply wrong. We are not the ones that are squashing everybody's fun. It is the sexual libertines that not just squash the fun, but actually extinguish the lives, the rights, and the well-being of the most vulnerable.
Well, and honestly, those sexual practices that have gained the biggest foothold in our culture are the ones in which they've been able to properly stash and silence the victims of those things to the margins, where we don't get to hear the testimony of the child that lost their life in the womb. We are still too young in some, I mean, we're just hitting that barrier now of the transgender debate to where detransitioners who are 19 and 20 who had a double mastectomy are now able to say, this was wrong. And you should have never let me do this. And I'm going to sue everyone who was complicit in this. It's almost like the consequences have to grow up or we have to amplify them so people can see this ethic is not without its victims. You've just done a good job of hiding them.
Yeah. Well, we are going to do a recap of some of the biggest headlines over the last couple months. And there are a lot of them, and many of them directly intersect with protecting the least of these, protecting children, protecting the most vulnerable. We can kick off with the fact that President Trump pardoned several pro-lifers who had been imprisoned for being a peaceful presence outside of abortion centers. Many of these, they were grandmas, they were moms, they weren't touching anybody, assaulting anybody. They were praying, they were standing, maybe sometimes they were quietly speaking to the women who were going into abortion clinics. And they threw those people in prison in what is very, very clearly a skewed perspective when it comes to who is in the right and who is in the wrong on the side of abortion. As we know, especially post-Dobbs, post the Supreme Court case that overturned Roe versus Wade, there were probably 100 cases of vandalism and violence against pro-life clinics. And none of them, as far as I know, were prosecuted in any way. And yet, you have grandmas praying quietly outside of pro-life clinics that were imprisoned, and President Trump pardoned them. So while he softened through, I think, very coercive measures, the pro-life plank of the GOP's platform, he has proved himself to be a man that at minimum cares about the people in the pro-life movement, even if perhaps he is not convictionally anti-abortion in his personal life.
Yeah, that this FACE Act is great what President Trump did. It's also, we should all be wary of anytime we create a political tool with a good intention that can be utilized against those with these types of morals or that we believe, you know, are on the right. The big issue I have with the FACE Act was they put out this thing that said basically pro-life and pro-choice, these abortion clinics and these pregnancy centers, we're protecting all of them. You do anything, you're in big trouble. Well, I think the White House report said that 97% of FACE Act prosecutions were against pro-life individuals doing things like praying, 97%. So you either tell me that pro-life individuals are 97% more likely to do something like this, to protest or picket, and 3% less likely. I mean, the numbers just don't add up. So again, it's a good testimony to this has been an abused law. I'm hoping that they provide more guidance. I don't think it's necessarily in the cards to have a repeal or anything like that, but man, these type of prosecutorial discretion can be used as a weapon, and I'm glad at least to see some of these folks get out of jail. It's just silly to see it, yeah. Especially when it's being misapplied like this.
Absolutely. There was a finger on the scale of justice, and it was against the people that were trying to protect the lives of children. The justices also weighed into a couple critical cases that have to do with child protection since the beginning of 2025. One of them was the Supreme Court hearing the case of the U.S. versus Scrimeti when it comes to gender transitions for minors. So this was a case brought to see whether or not the states could ban gender transitions for children. Several states have passed laws saying, hey, if you're going to do a transgender surgery, it cannot be on a child who is under 18 years old. And that was challenged. Interestingly, both sides would say, we're doing this for the kids. But I'll tell you what, the side that is on child sterilization, mutilation, and making them into permanent medical patients is not on the side of kids. So the Supreme Court heard those arguments in early January.
Yeah, I think we have so many protections for kids to prevent them from leading, you know, their own care or their own, you know, themselves into these life-altering decisions, to not let them make decisions until certain points in their life. And I know the other side will say, if we don't start this, then there's all these terrible consequences. You know, however, it's also been an incredibly deceptive process to saying, well, you can pause your fertility. And there are just lifelong consequences. I don't think we know anything about all the long-term signs point to horrible health. I'm so glad as a result that we are taking strong protections, honestly playing the role of parents in some degree. They should be protecting their kids like this. The second case that came out of SCOTUS was one that we personally submitted an amicus brief for. It was the Free Speech Coalition versus Paxton. And even in the framing of that, the Free Speech Coalition, it makes it seem so nice. That is a group of porn producers who are trying to have their speech protected down to the level of any child with a smartphone being able to see whatever they make. And that is an affront to justice. And we don't want that in our country. I mean, at the end of the day, I think we don't want that in our country.
Yeah. At bottom, both of these cases are state-level politicians who are trying to enact very common sense, very pro-child legislation at the state level, which is where a lot of this needs to be addressed. The first are saying, you do not have a right to victimize children's bodies. Children have a right to an intact, unmedicalized body, and we are going to prevent you through state law from violating that. The second is saying, children have a right to innocence. We, as the adults in the state, have a right to protect children from accidentally or casually accessing these kinds of graphic, sexualized materials that easily addicts them, that has long-term consequences for their own sexual health and relationships, and putting up a guardrail around that. And so the Supreme Court is going to decide on both those cases. We feel hopeful. It looks like from the oral arguments that it seems a majority of justices are going to side with kids. We can pray along those lines, and we will keep you updated on these cases. Stay tuned for more trending news.
Welcome back to Them Before Us on American Family Radio.
We're back with Them Before Us Radio. I'm your host, Katie Faust, founder and president of Them Before Us, here with my executive director, Josh Wood. And we just covered some of the national news stories, President Trump's pardoning of the pro-lifers who were peacefully praying and then imprisoned for their efforts, and then also a couple Supreme Court cases that came before the justices on matters that pertain to children's rights. But we also want to talk a little bit about things that are happening on the state level and some wider cultural trends as well, because there's been a lot happening in the beginning of 2025. So Josh, let's kick things off with what is happening in terms of parenthood laws and surrogacy laws, specifically in Massachusetts and Michigan.
Well, I think surrogacy specifically is coming to the forefront as one of the next frontiers of this debate around sex, gender, and family formation. And so these acts, one Parentage Act and one commercial surrogacy law that went into effect in both Massachusetts and Michigan, they were things we got really involved in. And what strikes me is, well, you know, we just spent all this time talking about these national cases, so many of them tied to state level action. I don't think people often understand how much the states do and how often they are leading the way in both enacting things that other states pick up on and then do themselves, or that create these challenges like we saw in Scrimeti in the last segment that turned into now a Supreme Court case. And so it is really important, and we take it very seriously at Them Before Us, to highlight when something egregious is happening, something that's going to have a massive effect on the lives of children, that's going to harm them, and that we know could set a standard, could create a path for other states to do something similar. And so the Massachusetts Parentage Act commercialized gestational and genetic surrogacy and removed mother and father language from the state's family law, allows courts to list more than two parents on a child's birth certificate. So you can go through those. There's a lot of challenges. One that I would highlight that I think a lot of the news programs that we kind of pitched this to and shared, hey, do you know this is going on? They really resonated with and wanted to share about was this idea of genetic surrogacy, where a woman will take her own egg, will get pregnant, oftentimes the normal way, with a commissioning parent, someone who's paid money to have the child, and then they will hand their child over after. Again, this is, my background is in the humanitarian field. We did a lot of work in anti-trafficking. I've supported a lot of organizations that do anti-trafficking work. When you exchange funds for someone's child, I don't care if it's in the womb, outside the womb, when you sign the contract, if someone's handing over their child, if we were in another country, if we're in the Philippines, and someone says, hey, I'll give you $60,000 for me to have sex with you and then for me to take your child and you never get to see him again and you have no rights to say anything about them ever again. And they said, sure, sign the contract. That would be an investigative report. I mean, we would have outrage in the international community over this. And in fact, much of the international community takes a harder line on this than the United States does. But that is what is now law in our own country. That's what this bill did. And to me, that is just an absolute shocking, it's a nightmare. I can't believe it. But now our duty is to make sure this doesn't go any further.
One of the reasons I started Them Before Us is because there had been sometimes erosion, but sometimes an all-out targeting of different states to deconstruct the rights of children in things like this, where there isn't a lot of attention, where there is a lot of moral confusion. I mean, honestly, when some of these surrogacy bills are proposed, sometimes pro-life or conservative lawmakers will say, well, that doesn't seem that bad to me. I don't see a problem with that. Sometimes the only entities that would object to a commercial surrogacy bill, for example, where children were going to be made intentionally motherless and go home with an unvetted, unrelated single man, double man, or triple man. Sometimes the only people that would object would be the insurance company, who's like, oh, sounds like that's going to cost us a lot of money. And that enraged me. We are talking about the lives of children. And there wasn't anybody that was saying, wait a second, this actually is going to victimize kids, and then worked to articulate their position on it. So with both Massachusetts and Michigan, two states that passed egregious child-harming bills, unfortunately, We were major players in sounding the alarm about those bills, about building coalitions and fortifying the people on the ground to be able to fight against it. Unfortunately, we lost out on those cases. Why is that? Well, because the other side has the deepest pockets, endless lawyers, and an armada who will come out in support of these bills. You know, you've got an entire party in the United States that testifies on behalf of separating children from their mothers and fathers if these kinds of bills come to committee. So if you're interested in this kind of thing, I just would say come to thembeforeus.com and subscribe, because this year we have even more resources. We're going to try to turn even more of our attention, not just to fighting bad legislation, but creating, pitching, and supporting good legislation. We'd love for you to be a part of that and know about it. So come to thembeforeus.com and subscribe. We have to do battle on behalf of children on these legislative issues, state by state, and even across the nation. We spend a lot of time talking about IVF and surrogacy because it is a wild west. A lot of states have no regulations about this. A lot of times there's nothing on the books. And so it is a vacuum that the fertility world is happy to fill. But there's other areas of family law that came under fire this year. One of them is New York has repealed its decriminalization of infidelity. In essence, they're saying it's no big deal if you cheat on your spouse anymore. And there's a very good case to be made that those kinds of arguments come into play because we enact and normalize no-fault divorce. So that's exactly what happened. New York was the last state to legalize no-fault divorce. They went from an at-fault divorce system where somebody has to be at fault if you want to get a divorce. And then the person that is at fault of abuse or abandonment or addiction or adultery gets punished. Maybe they don't get as much of custody. Maybe they are not rewarded with the house. Maybe the judge can just penalize them for their bad behavior. But when you move to a no-fault divorce system, there's no fault, you know? Everything's fine. I mean, for the abuser, for the adulterer, for the addict, for the one that has abandoned the marriage, there's no consequences. There can't be any consequences with no-fault divorce. No-fault divorce is not a victimless crime. It harms kids and it harms the innocent spouse. And now we're seeing one of the harms being a completely destigmatized idea of infidelity within marriage.
Well, and if you think about this, you could picture a situation where a family has sacrificed for one of the spouses to go through medical school, for example, or they're working very hard. They've saved the husband has completed medical school. The wife has, they've gone into potentially debt for this. They've scrimped on their savings to spend every dollar not to go into debt. And suddenly they find out that the husband has committed adultery, broken the covenant, is committed to continuing to do that, and wants a dissolution of the marriage. Let's say there's kids involved. What this would do is it would prohibit listing or bringing that into the decision or the consequences in the discussion around this with the judge. Now, this doesn't make sense. This spouse who's been doing the right thing, who wants to even work on it or reconcile, is committed to that. You've got the other spouse who's now committed to, I'm out of here. One spouse has been horribly wronged, one responsible spouse, one who, in exchange for this recognition of marriage by the state, has agreed to abide by the terms, has received benefits as a result, has tried to raise children in a stable environment. They are now being horribly wronged by this other offending spouse, and now this state is saying, you can't even bring that in. That can't factor into how we divide this up. Personally, that's just not accountability. We talk about penalizing them. I'm like, let's hold them accountable to the way in which they have made the lives of their spouse, their kids, their wife, their kids horrible in this situation. And someone needs to account for that. You've made a decision and you need to pay for it.
Whether you consider it a sacrament, whether you consider it a covenant, or whether you consider it a contract, there is probably no more important relationship to the fabric of our nation, the thriving of our nation, than marriage. And what no-fault divorce does is it makes it very easy to, with one little thread, unravel the entire thing. No-fault divorce was the original redefinition of marriage. It was the original legal decision that transformed what used to be the most child-friendly institution the world has ever known, the true building block of society, into simply a vehicle of adult fulfillment. And now we are seeing that even something like infidelity isn't something that can be challenged or questioned. That's just one more sort of no downside decision that somebody can make. Unfortunately, it's anything but when you're talking about the smallest society, the home, that is the staging ground for child formation, human formation, child development, identity formation, and the stability that kids desperately need. So there's a couple states that have done it terribly wrong. Ohio is not one of them. Governor Mark DeWine signed a Parents' Bill of Rights. This really does signal what I think is a temperature change across much of the country, a recognition that children belong to their parents, not to schools, not to doctors, not to counselors, not to activists, that children really are going to be best educated and cared for when their parents are recognized as primary educators, primary caregivers, and in charge of their medical decisions and upbringing. So to that end, Mike DeWine signed the Parents' Bill of Rights, reinforcing that parents' roles in children's education and recognizes that they should have a right to school choice. They should be informed about decisions that are happening within the school, and they should never have their child's transgender identity hidden from them in the name of children's right to privacy, for example.
Yeah, I think the sea change here is going from an assumption of these powerful institutions being the authority to the parent as a protector, as a guardian, as a guide, having to have this proved to them that what you are trying to push, teach, or you know, diagnose, you have to prove to me. There's a burden of proof. It's almost like we're shifting the burden of proof back to these institutions. I think we saw that through, I think parents became disillusioned through COVID when it said, hey, we're going to send all the kids home. It's what's best. We can do this all digitally. It won't matter. We need to protect kids. And turned out that there's a generation of kids now who basically dropped out during that time period. I think you saw the same thing with vaccinations. It was, you know, we're going to do this now. And any dissent whatsoever is irresponsible. They put the death of people on those who resisted instead of recognizing that some of this is experimental. We don't know all the effects of it. We're going to make room for your doubts. We're going to suggest this course of action, but you've got some space to make these decisions for your kids. We're going to respect your right to guard and protect your child and to be inquisitive about these things. That's what I'm seeing in this is the return of the parent as, these are my kids. You prove to me what you're saying. I need to see data. I have the right to ask questions, and I'm going to be able to opt out if I think it's in my child's best interest. And I think that's a default. That's the right position for parents to be in.
Very interesting that this is not necessarily falling along political lines. Even progressive adults want to know what you're doing with their kids at school. There is something that is universal about don't touch my kids. And it's very, very good. Why? Because parents do have a natural inborn protectiveness and connectedness to children that, for example, the fourth grade teacher or the doctor that is seeing your child maybe once, maybe 10 times, simply does not have. So that's why parents are vested with a specific interest and a right to direct the care and upbringing of their children. We just want that same level of protectiveness, that don't touch the kids, to apply to all kids, even if their parents might be misguided about some of the decisions that they're making. And that is why at Them Before Us, we advocate from the perspective of child protection on all these issues. There has been some changing cultural trends, or I would say accelerating cultural trends that we've been able to measure and discuss in the beginning of 2025. One of those is sort of this ever-expanding phase of adolescence, where, you know, you look at other cultures, whether it is, you know, the Jewish culture where they have a hard line, there's a bar mitzvah, this is when you go from being a boy to being a man, whether you've got the quinceañera, you know, in Mexico or the Latin American countries, this is where you go from being a girl to being a woman. We don't really have that kind of thing in America. You know, as you and I were discussing on an earlier episode, we have marriage. Marriage is probably the last major demarcation, especially for men, between childhood and adulthood. What happens when fewer and fewer people are married? So that's what we're seeing is generations that simply are not growing up. And specifically, a growing number of young adults are delaying major milestones for adulthood, like home ownership, like marriage, like financial independence. You know, the trope about living in your parents' basement. Kind of a reality, unfortunately, for a lot of teens and adolescents. So Josh, you know, what are some of the reasons why you think these cultural trends have taken hold?
Well, I do think culture is wrestling with the fact that religion used to provide a lot of these rites and passages and rituals for us. You know, there's baptisms, there's confirmations, there's marriage, there's even funerals. All of these things help people to process life events. And by nature, religious communities give you community. They give you other people to process things with. Religious communities also give you intergenerational living, which, again, extended families, which we have less and less around us these days. I think we're dealing with isolated individuals. We're dealing with people who are growing up without this religious infrastructure, and they're having trouble processing their changing stages of life. The fact that, you know, so there's something about, you know, having your wife give birth to a child that changes your perspective on life. There's something about going to a funeral at age 16 and seeing that life is short, even especially when it's the funeral of a 40-year-old man. And you're like, oh my gosh, what am I doing? I'm just, you know, I'm messing my life away playing video games. There's a certain element of these things being very formative for us. So I think that's probably what I would attribute it to.
There's certainly economic factors. There's certainly worldview factors. But one of the greatest factors is parenting. If you're listening to this, if you've got kids in your home, your job is training. It's not to keep them safe. It's not to helicopter around them. It is to train them for the real world, to be independent, to make good decisions, and ultimately to move out, start their own family, and begin the whole process again. Stay with us. We're going to come back with your questions in just a minute.
If you'd like to comment on the show, email comments@thembeforeus.com. Once again, here's Katie Faust.
We're back with Them Before Us Radio. I'm your host, Katie Faust, and I'm always joined in this final third with my training director, Jen Friesen, who has collated a bunch of questions that you guys have pitched us through the week. And this week, we're doing something a little different. So Jen, tell me what our listeners have in store for them.
Well, this is a kind of big recap episode. So we took 10 of the best questions, actually kind of from all time, for our radio show. And I'm going to ask you kind of rapid fire pop quiz, each of the 10 questions. And we'll see how many you can get through with about the most concise elevator answers ever. And then we'll have our listeners grade you. And they can, you guys can tell us in the comments or via email us at themforeus.com. What grade you would give Katie for these answers?
Don't vote me off the island, please.
Yeah. All right. So the clock is going. The first one, let's start with an easy one. Why is adoption okay if you say surrogacy is wrong?
Okay. Okay. Fastest answer ever. All right. So in adoption, the child is the client. The goal is to give the child loving parents. And in if you're successful in 100% of cases, children go home with vetted loving adults who are, I am failing at this. Oh my gosh. I'm trying to do this fast, but vetted loving adults who have committed to love them as if the child had been born to them. But in surrogacy, the adults are the client. The goal is to get the adults a baby no matter the cost. Sometimes that means burning through dozens of embryos. Sometimes it means cutting the child's mother or father out of their life completely. Sometimes it means going home with a known pedophile because there's no kinds of screening or vetting. So I would say the biggest difference is in adoption, the child is client and their best interest reigns. In surrogacy, the adult is the client and the checkbook reigns.
That's so good. You know, if I was being snarky on a Facebook comment too, I'd say, well, one person has to pass a background check and the other person doesn't. Isn't that crazy? Right? Great job though. Good way to kick us off.
Okay.
Can it be ethical to donate sperm and eggs as long as you are okay not being anonymous?
No. You're cutting a child off from their mother or father. They don't just want to know who you are. They want to be loved by you. They don't want to be loved by you once a week or on holidays. They want to be loved by you every day. They deserve to be loved by you every day. It's not enough to just say, hey, kid, here's my medical records. They want you to take them on father-daughter dates. They want you to coach their t-ball team. That is what children want and deserve. It is never, never ethical to donate, which is, let's be honest, you're selling. You're selling your sperm and your egg. It's not ethical to cut children off from their mother or father. We mourn when that happens tragically. We should object and tear our garments when it happens intentionally and commercially.
That's good. People might have to put this at 0.5 speed to be able to cover all that. Remember it. Okay, another easy one. This person's in a 20-year marriage, but can I leave if it will make me truly happy?
Statistics says you're just as likely to be truly as unhappy as you are now after you get divorced. Divorce probably isn't going to solve the problem. Second, if you choose to remarry, you're probably just going to replicate those issues in your next marriage. Third, if you've got kids, you're going to devastate them. So whatever temporary escape or whatever fabricated or imagined happiness that you think is on the other side of this, just be really honest. You're trading your children's physical health, mental health, emotional health, academic health, and relational health, so you can have a temporary escape or, you know, an immediate escape. You're just saying, hey, look, kid, this burden is too heavy for me. You take it instead.
Boom. Mic drop. Is same-sex parenting really different? Studies say that the kids are fine.
Yeah, interestingly, none of those studies, or hardly any of those studies, use randomly derived participants. Few of them have adequate control groups. Most of them are teeny little sample sizes. Interestingly, whenever we're studying family structure that is not same-sex parenting, sociologists agree that biology benefits children in the parent-child relationship in terms of higher levels of investment, protection, and connection, that men and women offer distinct and complementary benefits to children when it comes to their development, and that only the two biological adults contribute to a stable identity formation. So it's so weird that with same-sex parented homes, those studies showed that the kids do just as well, even though they're always missing a biological parent, they're always starved of maternal or paternal love, and they're always missing at least 50% of the identity formation component that they need. The bottom line is those studies are garbage. Go with what is self-evident and common sense. Children come from a man and woman. The overwhelming sociological evidence says they benefit from and are most protected when they're raised by that man and woman, and that our marriage laws should then incentivize that union so that children don't have to lose that man or that woman to be raised in that household.
That's good. This is our fifth question. You're doing great.
Okay.
I'm considering running for a local office because I want to push back against policies that harm children. What are some key talking points I can use to explain why prioritizing children's rights should be a main political issue?
Okay. I love you, first of all. Like, let's be BFFs, because that's the right kind of motivation to get into the political space. Politics is all about justice, giving others what they are due. Children are due our protection. And unfortunately, they're the demographic that cannot advocate for themselves. Your entire political philosophy, if I was your counselor, would be to prioritize children in everything. Putting children first is the hack when it comes to arriving at the right policy conclusions, whether the question is cultural, legal, technological, corporate. If you elevate the rights and well-being of the next generation, you tend to get great policy. We have an entire book about that. It's called Pro-Child Politics. Love it. Mark it up. Make it your own. Write us and tell us how you're defending kids, and then we will stand on the top of our rooftops and cheer you on.
That's awesome. All right. My 12-year-old says she's non-binary. What should I do?
You probably need to, in as much as possible, cut her off from social media. It's very likely that she is dabbling in these kinds of identities because of the social contagion that is most directly fed straight into their veins through social media. She probably is in some kind of Reddit group, or she's following TikTok pages that are exposing her to dozens or hundreds of testimonials and probably activists who are grooming her into this self-understanding that rejects her body. So you need to extremely limit her digital communication platforms. And then you need to maximize and increase your in-personal connection with her. Do as much as you can in person, away from screens, go on runs, take her on a mission trip, just do household chores with her, maximize your in-person connection so that you can start to supplant the influences of online with the influences of mom and dad.
That's awesome. You answered a similar question, but a slightly different take. What should I tell a friend who's considering leaving her husband? They have two elementary age children.
I would say pick up our first book, Them Before Us, Why We Need a Global Children's Rights Movement. Read chapter 5, which talks about all of the different harms to children. But it also includes about 24 testimonies of children who grew up in divorced homes. Make them read it. Say, hey, can you just read this chapter, specifically the testimonies of kids? Look at how this actually has a connection to their decreased sexual health, increase in skin and gut problems, a higher likelihood of all kinds of chronic illnesses when they are older. Look at how the loss of a father post-divorce, for example, shortens the telomeres, the end caps of their chromosomes. You're shortening their lifespan with this decision. Get to know the data, get to know the stories, and as much as possible, expose her to them.
That's awesome. How important is it to keep biological siblings together in adoption or foster care?
As much as you can, you have to do it. It's a huge, huge priority. These children have already been severed from a lot of the different kinship bonds that children are made for, that they thrive on, that they have a natural right to. It is important to prioritize those sibling groups, whether you are talking about a traditional adoption or if you're one of those people that are considering embryo adoption because children have been abandoned, forsaken, in a frozen cryogenic storage tank. Always prioritize keeping siblings together. We know that children created through sperm and egg donation very often go on protracted searches, not just for their missing biological parent, but there are dozens or maybe hundreds of half siblings that are out there because they care. They care who they're related to, and they deserve to be raised with them whenever possible.
With high divorce rates and the way the world is going, what's the point of marriage and children?
Mm-hmm. So divorce rates have actually declined over the last couple decades, largely because marriage rates have declined. The good news is that there's a lot of factors that you can do to control your likelihood of divorce, specifically being on the same page in terms of worldview with your spouse, refusing premarital sex, refusing cohabitation, going through some kinds of premarital counseling. And then once you do get married, attending weekly religious services together, is going to, all of those things are going to drop your divorce risk to probably below 10%. So divorce is by no means inevitable. With the state of the world, it just tells you we need more marriage and more children. We often talk on that before us about why we're looking at an absolute fertility bomb that's going to go off. We're not having enough children, even though we are materially wealthier than pretty much any other generation that has come before us. So economics should not stop you from having children, even if it looked like the world was about to come to an end. You know what saves it? Happy marriages, happy babies, more intellectual human capital that can solve some of the greatest problems that we're facing today. It is one of the greatest untapped resources that we have. So get married, have babies, show the rest of the world how it's done.
That's awesome. Okay, we have about 4 minutes left. This is your 10th question. That was fast, but you get to spend a little bit longer on this one because I saved the doozy for number 10. So do you personally, you can speak as you, Katie Faust, I don't think Them Before Us has specifically stated a position on this, think it's moral to create life in glass or in a lab?
Mm-hmm. The children's rights answer is you should not victimize any child's right to life or right to their mother or father. That's the concrete fundamental right. I really am concerned about things like exposure to light. You know, babies aren't supposed to be conceived in light. They're supposed to be conceived in darkness, in the warmth of their mother's womb. We're not supposed to select which sperm we inject. That's supposed to be a self-selecting process. Probably one of the reasons why some IVF children have higher rates of cancers or developmental disabilities is because there's a sorting mechanism that takes place during natural procreation that is absent when a technician is presiding over this. I understand that there are some children that wouldn't exist without these technologies and their lives are altogether good, but it's very hard for me to see how this is ever a them before us prospect, how this ever could be purely the adults sacrificing so children don't have to. It to me looks like there's always some aspect of child sacrifice that goes into IVF, even if you supposedly do it in a pro-life way. Does my Bible, that is my ultimate authority, give hard and fast guidelines to say IVF can never be something that is permissible? I don't think I could make that case biblically, but from the perspective of the ethics of just saying that the weak should never sacrifice for the strong, it's very hard for me to see an ethical case for that. But since we have some time, Jen, I want to hear your thoughts to that question.
Yeah, we were chatting about this in a group setting that I was in about a family that had been desperate to have children. And they're religious. They were like, okay, we're going to pursue IVF. And that's how God's going to provide us children. And they went from coveting and wishing they could have and desiring children so much that they're paying thousands of dollars, created 6 embryos, had 4 children, 2 sets of twins. And now they're like, we can't do the other 2. We can't handle it. And it was interesting to me how they went from, we'll do anything to have children, to now, well, we have 6. But now we don't want to do what it would take to have those other 6, because that's going to be, we can't afford it. I'm older and I can't do the pregnancy. And we talked about in this group setting, I was like, this is the problem when we at some level start playing God. Who lives, who dies? What gender will I take? Yeah, which sperm are we selecting? What's the quality of my eggs? Let's discard the embryos. Well, if we start playing God, you end up having to make God decisions, life and death. And to me, I think that philosophically is the problem with, yeah, is it ever ethical to make a human in glass? I personally wrestle with that. I don't know if we ever should, because of the implications later. Well, that at some level, yes, we're allowed to use technology, but when we're doing technology for life and death, ultimate life and death questions, not even like, do I get a heart transplant or not, you know? We get into some really messy ethical places, it seems.
I think, you know, I've heard about the, how do we know when to use technology and when not to? It always needs to be restorative, right? And that's why we often will advocate for restorative reproductive medicine, things like NAPRO technology that seeks to identify and resolve the underlying sources of infertility, right? Then you're using technology to restore something that should not be broken. I mean, that's what it means when you're like, you've got a broken bone, you're going to reset the bone. You're using medicine to restore something. Whenever you're circumventing human nature, whenever you're going outside of the natural processes, that is when you need to take a very skeptical position. And that is what IVF is. It is circumventing the natural processes. You could actually say the same thing about birth control. Birth control is circumventing. It is obstructing. It's going outside of the natural systems of our body. Mary Harrington makes the case that birth control was the first transhumanist technology. It wants to transcend our human capacity, in essence, by making women function more like men in terms of their cycles and their urges and their drives. So that's a pretty good metric to use. If you're circumventing natural human nature, then it's probably outside of God's will. If you're using technology in a way that restores your physical body, gets you back to a place of health, that is something that can be embraced. Well, this was so fun, Jenna. Thank you so much. I love the kind of questions that we receive. You should tell us yours, us at thembeforeus.com. We love chatting with you, interacting, fielding your questions. Thanks for being with us. We will see you next week.
The views and opinions expressed in this broadcast do not necessarily reflect those of the American Family Association or American Family Radio.